Well, let's take our Bible now and turn to Hebrews once again. If you've been with us the last, couple years, but certainly the last few weeks, we have been studying the book of Hebrews, and we're in Hebrews 3 at the moment. Hebrews chapter 3, we've taken it upon ourselves over the last couple of weeks to do a fairly, well, as much as we can, a thorough study on the subject of apostasy. Apostasy. We're trying to get a handle on what I call the phenomenon of apostasy. What's apostasy? That's where someone who once said they were a Christian, said they believed in Christ for salvation, and then one day they, and more likely over time, walked away from it all. They abandoned Christ, they abandoned the faith. That's apostasy. I think this has piqued everybody's interest. I've gotten a number of folks who've given me feedback who said that it was helpful. Even if you're not apostatizing, it's just a way of awakening you to the danger of apostasy. And that's the whole point of what we're looking at here. I mean, I think also we all know folks who fall into this category. Perhaps, and I've shared with you, close friends, family, folks who, you know, once we worshiped with, served with, prayed with, and now have no absolute interest in any of that anymore. What do you do with that? It's probably the question that immediately comes. How do you explain it? What theological file do you put them in? I mean, were they Christians and then lost their salvation? Or were they never Christians to begin with? Well, the book of Hebrews helps us with this. This text of scripture that we've arrived at, Hebrews 3, verse 7, and really all the way to the end of the chapter, and we'll actually squeeze in verse 1 of chapter 4. That's the text that we're looking at. Hebrews 3, verse 7, all the way down to chapter 4, verse 1. And collectively and as a whole, it's a warning. I've said that over the last couple of weeks, but if you weren't here, from verse 7 of Hebrews 3 down to chapter 4, verse 1, collectively and as a whole, it is a warning. A warning. It's a warning not to apostatize. The writer of Hebrews sees in this people that he writes to a danger. A danger. He sees something, what's going on in them, what they do, what they say, and he has to warn them. In fact, you could say that the book of Hebrews is a sermon, as we've actually said all along. And like any sermon, you quote the Bible. And so you can see that most of the text here is Psalm 95. You notice that? And in Psalm 95, we've mentioned it, so I don't want to go all the way back to and rehearse everything we've said. But Psalm 95, the psalmist there is rehearsing the Hebrews of the Exodus. You know those Israelites. Jacob and his sons went down to Israel. Remember, Joseph went before him with the famine. You know that story at the end of Genesis. So number of years, hundreds of years, they lived in Egypt. And then Exodus opens up with Moses, an encounter with God, and telling Moses to go down, tell Pharaoh to free my people, let my people go. And they take off, as you know. And it wasn't far from Egypt that they started to grumble, right? They started to complain. They began to murmur, which, by the way, is a dead giveaway that you're backsliding on your way to apostasy. I mentioned that last week, didn't I? If you find yourself murmuring, complaining, and grumbling, or you know somebody that's murmuring, complaining, and grumbling, that's a dead giveaway that something's not right. Something's going on in their heart. And what they were really doing is the psalmist says, and as the writer of Hebrews is quoting him, is that they tested God. Do you see that? There in verse 8, they tested God. They rebelled against God. What did they want to do? They wanted to go back to Egypt. They wanted to go back to their old life. They were actually happy to abandon God. Imagine that. They were happy to abandon Moses, happy to abandon God, happy to abandon whatever this promised land that, you know, they were heading to. Not interested in his blessings. And you say, what was going on there? I mean, why would they want to do that? Well, what was the problem? Well, the key problem for them, and the very thing that they were missing, was what? What do you think was missing? Look at chapter 4, verse 2. Here's what was missing. For good news came to us just as to them. That's the Hebrews, right? He's making a comparison. You're just like the Hebrews, but here, let me make the parallels. For good news came to us just as it came to them. That is the Hebrews, as I said. But the message they heard did not benefit them. Why didn't it benefit them? Why didn't it do them any good? Here it is. Because they were not united by faith with those who listen. You might have some kind of translation as, well, they heard it, but it wasn't mixed with faith. And that's always the issue. You understand that. At the end of the day, the reason why they wanted to go back is because they did not believe. It was unbelief. They did not have faith. Now, if you want to go a bit further, and the writer of Hebrews does, a bit more specific, and even the psalmist does, and it comes by way of the warning, they did not have faith, but they did more than not just believe. You'll notice, verse 8, they hardened their hearts. You see that? And that's why it comes in the warning. In fact, the writer of Hebrews here mentions it three times. He mentions it in verse 8, where he says, do not harden your hearts. You go down to verse 15. Again, do not harden your hearts. You flip the page over to chapter 4, verse 7. Again, it's a quote from Psalm 95 all three times. Do not harden your hearts. You often hear, you know, be soft. Be soft to the gospel. And that's what the gospel does. The gospel divides. Christ divides. We're going to see that again tonight, but we saw that on Friday with Simeon. Remember what Simeon said when he held the baby in his arms? He is for the rising and the falling of those in Israel. You are going to be soft to Jesus Christ. He's going to be a savior of life to life, or he's going to be a savior of death to death. You're going to soften your heart, spiritually, obviously speaking, or you're going to harden your heart to him. What did the wilderness generation do? What did the Hebrews do? They hardened their hearts. And here comes the warning. Don't do that. When you hear the gospel, when you hear the truths of God, do not harden your heart. And the message is still today. You're here. You're here. The Bible's open. You're hearing the gospel. And the warning to all of us is do not harden your hearts. Everybody got that? Now, you might be asking, what hardens a heart? Right? How do you harden a heart? Well, we're going to talk about that much of the morning, but just to start us off, look at verse 13. Here's exactly where it begins. What's verse 13 say? But exhort one another every day, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened, here it is, by the deceitfulness of sin. Everybody see that? What hardens a heart? Sin. Sin. The love of sin, the pleasure of sin. You could even say the sport of sin. Listen. Listen carefully. When sin is not mastered, right? Remember God said to Cain, sin is crouching at the door, and you must master it. Why? Because it wants to devour you. Remember that? And Cain should have turned around and said, what? How do you do that? I need help, right? But he didn't. But it's the same thing here. If sin is not mastered, when sin is not mortified, when it is not put to death, listen, what does James say? Sin is out there, it's like a bait, it's like a lure. You know, you look at it, you start playing with it. The more you look at it, it becomes, you know, the follow the pattern of Eve. It looks, you know, good to the eyes. It becomes a delicious delicacy. Now, we know the world is full of temptations, right? We walk outside. It's a smorgasbord out there. You understand that Satan and his demons, they know you. Let me just say it that way. They know you. You have a, whether you know it or not, you as a Christian have a target on the back of your shirt. And they know what lust you love. They know exactly what fires up the flesh, awakens the flesh. And so they'll put the bait out there. They'll put the lure out there for you. And listen, when your heart is not right, what happens? When your heart's not right, the evil desires are stirred up. The flesh is awakened. And you start talking to yourself, right? You start saying, it's a small little sin. I mean, why not? Nobody's around. Nobody's going to get hurt. Who's going to see? I mean, it's not murder or anything. I mean, does that sound familiar? The justification goes round and round and round, and ultimately, well, sin is conceived, James says, and there's no coming back, and you give in. You give in to that temptation. Now, if you're a Christian, Lord willing, you feel bad, right? Conscience is struck. You want to repent. Let's hope you do confess. Repent. Let's hope you do confess. But looking back, what happened there? What happened there so it doesn't happen again? Well, verse 13 is really the point is you've been duped. You've been deceived. And we can say more about how to master sin, how to mortify sin, and I want to do that at the end of our little series on how what are the safeguards to backsliding and apostasy. But just a thought here is, look at verse 12. Here's the warning. Look at the warning. Verse 12, take care. Take care. In other words, look after yourself. Watch yourself closely. Guard your life, or guard your heart. You need to be on the alert. Take care. Why? Lest there be in any of you any evil, unbelieving heart. Because that's where it is. Your heart is the mission control center, right? It always begins in the heart. We need to make sure we have a pure and clean heart. Because if we don't, well, there it is at the end. The potential is a falling away, right? Falling away from the living God. And that's the danger. And that's the apostasy, right? When we talk about apostasy, it's a falling away. I mean, you remember that the book of Hebrews is written to brand new Christians. Everybody in the first century was a brand new Christian, right? Brand new Jewish Christians. And the writer of Hebrews, as I said, sees something in them that puts pen to paper because he sees a danger of apostasy. That's why at the front of the book he says, to the Hebrews. And we've said, that's a bit of a sting. He's saying, you are acting just like those Hebrews. And that's why he's quoting Psalm 95. And he keeps referring back to the wilderness generation because where you're heading is just like them, which is ultimately apostasy. The Hebrews are the paradigm of apostasy. If you want a portrait of apostasy, just look at the Hebrews. And so these Christians that he writes to, as you move through the book of Hebrews, certain things come out which makes you understand why he's writing it. They were drifting. Many of them were sluggish. Many of them were immature, where they should have been long far in their Christian life. I mean, they've been Christian for years, let's say. They haven't even gone past the fundamentals. Remember when we get to Hebrews 7, he wants to talk about Melchizedek, right? I want to talk to you about Melchizedek because that's so important so you understand who Christ is in his priesthood. He's not of the order of Levi because he's from the tribe of Judah, but he's of the tribe of Judah, but he's like the priest of Melchizedek and thus an order of Melchizedek. But I can't talk to you like that. I mean, that's meat. That's heavy. I can't even talk to you about that because you're still at milk level. So they're drifting, they're sluggish, immature, and you remember in Hebrews 10:25, many of them have what? They've abandoned the assembling. They've forsaken the gathering of the saints. I mean, you miss one Sunday here and there because you're sick or you're away, but then, you know, week after week, where are you? Well, I'm at home. Why aren't you coming to church? I'm not interested. And so 1 week goes into 2 weeks, 2 weeks goes into 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5, you know, 6 months later, they're never at church. And you say, well, I think they're Christians, and, you know, Christians don't have to go to church. You can worship God anywhere, right? God's omniscient, and so I can worship God anywhere. You've ever had those conversations with anybody? Why do I have to go to church? I can worship God anywhere. Well, if you're a Christian, let me say it this way. I normally say, well, that tells me you don't really understand what a Christian is. Because a Christian isn't just worshiping God. It is the fellowship with the saints. If you become part of the covenant relationship with God, you become a covenant part of His people. You have a new family. We can say more about that, but that's enough to say that these people were abandoning the worship and the fellowship. So this is why they needed to be warned, right? I mean, this is part of the deal of being a Christian. This is why all of us need to be warned. It's a means of grace, right? When we talk about the means of grace, warning comes in it. Warning. You have to be warned because why? We know that our hearts can deceive us. We know that our hearts are prone to wander. We know that oftentimes we find ourselves out there in what Bunyan calls bypath meadow, right? So these warnings, you could say, are like signposts. These are for Christians, by the way. I don't want to rehearse everything we said a number of weeks ago, but these warnings are for Christians. These warnings are for you. You drive down the road. You don't know there's a bend around the corner until you see the sign. That helps you, right? These warnings throughout the Hebrews are like that. They're signs. They're a means of grace. The warning comes because when you hear the warning, what does it do to you, right? I heard some of you say that last week. Man, yeah, I think I've been backsliding. That's good. That's mercy. No, it's bad that you're backsliding, but it's good that you know that you are, right? You hear the warning, you prop yourself up, and the Spirit of God is working, and the conviction comes, and there's commitment and a reaction to I need to get my act together, right? So again, this is what I call the means of grace, the constant encouragement and exhortation to persevere, to press on, or as Paul puts it, to run in such a way to obtain the prize. We need to run, but we need to run carefully. Or at the end of the book of Hebrews, it says, don't entangle yourself. Untangle yourself so that you can run in such a way. We need to run as he puts it there in verse 1 of chapter 4 so that we don't what? Well, we don't want to think that we're running and never get there, right? In chapter 4, verse 1, he says, run in such a way that you do not fall short of entering God's promised rest. Do you see that? I mean, that was the Hebrews, right? They never got there. They never got there. So the warnings are for us to get there, right? So as I said, this warning here is for the first century Jewish Christians, but they're here for us as well. We need to hear this. We need to hear the warnings, and we need to heed the warnings. That's really apart from understanding the phenomenon of apostasy, trying to get our head around it, along the way, we've got to deal with the warnings and hear them and heed them. Now, to do that, really to hear and heed the warnings, if you look at the back of your bulletin, and I put it in there last week, I've come up with an outline. You see, I've got 5 points of how we're going to work our way through this. Last week, we looked at the stages. The outline, as I said, is there primarily for me, so I'm not rambling on and going to here and there, but it's also for you, so you can get that panorama portrait of apostasy. And how the warnings work. Just one change, however, and I forgot to tell Annabelle to put it. I'm swapping the seriousness for the sources this morning. We're going to look at the sources this morning. In other words, this morning we're going to look at the causes of apostasy. Last week we looked at the stages, how it begins with a drift and it ends in destruction. Right? Well, we're going to come back and say, well, where did it all begin? Let's think about the sources of apostasy or the causes. As I said, apostasy normally doesn't happen overnight. Right? It doesn't normally happen overnight. Sometimes it does, but normally it doesn't. It begins with a drift. And then it concludes with a full walking away where there is no coming back. It's done. So in our time remaining, I want us to think about this a bit. I want us to break down some of the, again, what we might call its sources, the sources or causes of apostasy. I've been reading, I think I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, I've been reading this book called, Finding Faith, Losing Faith. The author has talked to, interviewed, and also gone to the web, the internet, and pulled out people's stories who once were, might be called an evangelical. They may have said, look, I was an evangelical. And for one reason or another, they walked away. They may have walked away into a more, what we might call a liberal church, or completely walked away altogether and don't claim to be a Christian. And so I just was interested in hearing. I mean, I can look at and read the Bible and like you, pulled together some of the sources from a theological standpoint, and we're going to do that in a moment, but I just wanted to know what it was from a human standpoint. What was the so-called aha moment, right? And what did it for them? What was behind the drift, the ultimate lead to the apostasy? Well, it was interesting to hear some of the stories. Some of them, of course, said it was science. You probably hear this quite a bit. Science seemed to trump the Bible, right? They get fed through from high school all the way to the university that evolution makes sense, and obviously that with an agenda to refute the biblical description of creation in 6 days, 24 hours. And so for them, the Bible was not intellectually coherent. That word kept coming up. It was not intellectually coherent. You ever come across those? You ever talk to those who say, I can't believe the Bible. There's too many errors. I remember, I don't know if Bron remembers this. We just moved to Australia. We moved to Adelaide. And there was this dear couple across the street. They were German immigrants. And like the first or second day, Klaus, I think his name was, he says, what are you doing here? You know, American in Australia. I said, I'm here to teach the Bible. I'm lecturing at a local Bible college. His immediate response was, well, you know the Bible's full of errors. And I wanted to say, okay, so I'm an idiot. I mean, that's how I wanted to respond. In other words, you're calling me an idiot. And what do you say to that? I mean, the second response was, I did not know that. Could you show me the errors? Which he didn't have any. He did say that he got his answers from the Jehovah's Witnesses told him that, and then the Mormons told him that, and you know, so we had a conversation about it all. But I'm sure you've had those conversations as well. But people who are struggling because it just doesn't make sense to them. They just don't understand. And I always remember what Augustine, somebody can correct me later. Augustine said, you've got to believe to understand, not understand to believe. Does that make sense? Faith comes first. Is this Augustine that said that? You've got to believe to understand. Which makes the point. It's always about what? It's always about faith. And always about believing. So some struggle with science. Some actually, and you probably hear this as well, some call a struggle with the so-called justice of God, which theologically is the theodicy, the righteousness of God. Well, you know, you look at out in the world and all the suffering and all the oppression, all the hunger, you know, the injustices of the world. If there is a God, why isn't he doing anything about it? Right? You've heard that too, right? I'm not gonna worship a God that like that. Some saw the hypocrisy of Christians. I hear this every once in a while. The hypocrisy of Christians. I mean, here were all these people claiming to be righteous and godly, and they ended up being exposed as evil as everyone else. In the book, it came out quite personal. Some of them, you know, they thought they married a Christian. They went to church, and all of a sudden their spouse committed adultery and ended up walking right out the door. And the spouse that was left there in the house just saw, you know what? If this is Christianity, I don't want anything to do with it. So they abandoned the faith. No, thank you. You can have that Christian stuff. There was a number of other quote-unquote causes, sources, reasons. But the big one, of course, which probably is the one that you come down to in a word, is independence. Right? That was the issue in the garden. Autonomy. They did not want God to rule over them. They did not want Christ to rule over them. They wanted to do what they wanted to do. Why? Because they loved their sin. Ultimately, that's in there somewhere, even if they don't fully articulate it. The yoke of Christ was too heavy. He was no fun. There was no pleasure in it. I want to do what I want to do. And they express it in words like, finally, freedom. You ever talk to anybody like that? I just felt burdened and it was just too much, but now I found my freedom. So apostasy for many begin at different points. For some, it's intellectual reasons. For others, rational reasons. Still more, hypocritical reasons. But ultimately, the real cause of all apostasy is it's unbelief, but on the ground, you could say it's moral. Moral reasons. They love their sin. They just love it too much. They want to indulge the flesh too much. So what can we learn from this? Well, from here, let me take you to a more broad and general discussion of sources and causes of apostasy. I just sat down, like you, just with the pen and paper, and just jotted down what I saw were those things that created the initial backslide and then to the ultimate apostasy if it wasn't checked and stopped. There was a sense of a spiraling down from this particular point. And I came up with 11, if you're taking notes. I came up with 11 sources or 11 causes of apostasy. And I thought just in the timing of coming this Sunday to do it, this would be a good self-examination as we prepare ourselves for the Lord's Supper. Okay? So let me give you 11 sources of apostasy. Here's number one. Where does it all begin? Carelessness. I'm just going to use one word for each one. Carelessness. Carelessness. And we saw that earlier. Look at Hebrews 3:12 again. He says what? Take care. Because ultimately, if you don't take care, you're on your way. Take care, brothers, lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart. Why? Again, ask the question. Why do we need to take care? Because ultimately, it's going to lead you to what? A falling away from God. Same thing, by the way, is said back in chapter 2. Look back at chapter 2, verse 1. He says, for this reason we must pay much closer attention. It's the same kind of language. Take care. Pay much closer attention. Why? Because drifting is going to be a reality. Keep your finger in Hebrews and turn to Proverbs 24 for a moment. Look at Proverbs 24, verse 30. I thought this was interesting. I'm not sure if I saw it in the commentary, but I think this is the background to the warning in Hebrews 6 that I'll have you turn to in a moment. But in Proverbs 24, look at verse 30. I went by the field of the slothful. You see that? I went by the field of the slothful, the lazy, and by the vineyard of the man void of understanding. I mean, this is a fool. The slothful, the lazy, they're fools. And lo, the vineyard was all grown over with what? Thorns and nettles, and had covered the face thereof, and the stone wall thereof was broken down. It was a mess. There was no what? Taking care of it. And he says, then I saw and considered it well, and looked upon it and received instruction. In other words, this was a lesson for him. This is what happened when you don't take care, when you don't pay attention, when you don't look after a garden. But the parallel is to what? To your heart. Proverbs 4:23. You can turn there if you want. Proverbs 4:23. Guard or keep. The Hebrew word there is shamar, which is the same word that you see in Genesis. Remember Nathan talked about it at camp. Guard your heart. Why? Well, first of all, guard your heart with all vigilance, diligence. You might have it in your translation above all else. And the reason why it says above all else is because in the chapter of chapter 4, there's a mention before and after about looking after your feet. Don't go to places where you shouldn't be going. Guard your eyes. Don't look at things that you shouldn't see. Guard your hands. Why? Because, you know, you shouldn't be touching certain things. But above all else, guard your heart. And do it with diligence. Do it with vigilance. Why? Because, notice it says, for from it flows the what? The springs of life. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. The heart, you know, is the mission control center. The mission is, the heart is the mind, right? In the Semitic world. The heart is the mind. We think with our heart. The Old Testament, and even the New Testament says. If you want to look for a word that talks about feelings, you look for it in the bowels. Right? That's a Hebrew understanding. So guard your heart. Keep your heart. Why? For from it flows the springs of life. Now you go back to Hebrews. As I said, look at the parallel from that verse in Proverbs 24 to Hebrews 26. Or Hebrews 6, rather. Hebrews 6. And notice how the writer of Hebrews here is again picking up, I think, the imagery of Proverbs 24. Whether he was conscious of it or not, it is similar. Look at verse 7. He says, for land that has drunk the rain that often falls in it, and produces a crop useful to those for whose sake it is cultivated, receives a blessing from God. In other words, when the rain comes, and the garden is cultivated, when there's work on the ground, and the rain from God, which we all need, it needs water. You can cultivate all you want, you can fertilize all you want, but if there's no water, nothing, right? But here's the contrast. But if it bears what? Thorns and thistles. That's the same language that we saw in Proverbs 24. Thorns and nettles. But if it bears thorns and thistles, it is worthless and near to being cursed, and its end is to be burned. Now, why does the writer of Hebrews bring this in? In Hebrews 6, the context is another warning. We'll get there soon enough. What's he pointing to? Why is he bringing this up? Well, just coming to the chase, he's saying, look at your heart. What do you see in there? Is your heart taken care of? Have you been cultivating your heart? Have you guarded your heart? Have you been putting the right things in it? Because as they say, garbage in, garbage out, right? Because what happens if you don't take care of your heart? What happens if you don't take care of a garden? What's going to grow? Thorns and thistles. Right? Carelessness. That's the issue here. Carelessness. And the safeguard, of course, to flip it around, is what? Watchfulness. Watchfulness. Many of you read the Puritans. How many times have you've read within the Puritan literature the emphasis on being watchful? Being watchful. Watch your heart. Cultivate it. Put the right things in it. Read the right things. Listen to the right things. Be around the right people. Friendships. Remember a few weeks we talked about Friendships are a huge influence in your life. So what's the source of apostasy? What is maybe, you know, the first thing that goes is carelessness. Following that, number two, we'll call this idleness. Idleness. Remember King David? Remember how the story begins of his adultery with Bathsheba? And it says that, when all the armies were out there fighting Israel with the Philistines, David was home. Where should David have been? David should have been out there with his army. He's the king. But he's idle. He's doing nothing. And idleness leads to curiosity. Right? Looking. I saw Bathsheba. I mean, you know the story, but where did it all begin? It began with idleness. There's a sense of that thought there in Hebrews 2:1. Look at Hebrews 2:1 again. Certainly the last part. For this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard so that we do not drift away from it. That in a sense, is idleness. Because as I've said over and over again, drifting away happens when you do what? Nothing. Right? When you're not reading your Bible, when you're not praying, when you're not going to church, and you're not exercising any of the disciplines of grace, the means of grace, you start what? Drifting. In other words, you don't do anything. That's idleness. Doing nothing. I mean, you can call it laziness, you can call it apathy. And of course, the antithesis of it is earnestness and zealousness, right? If you're not idle, you're zealous. You're earnest. You are disciplined. Listen, where there is no discipline in the Christian life, and no exercise of the means of grace, backsliding is inevitable. And some of you know that, right? So idleness. Here's a third thought. Carelessness, idleness. Thirdly, we'll call this shallowness. Shallowness. Think about it. When faith has no root, follow me here, okay? When faith has no root, there's not going to be any real convictions, is there? So you say you have faith, but there's no root. In other words, there's no convictions. And then what comes? A trial, right? A test. Does he have faith or not? Does she have faith or not? So they say they have faith. The trial comes. The test comes. And because it hasn't any root, what do you think is going to happen? Well, because it has no root, it's going to be like chaff, right? It's going to just start drifting away and ultimately what? Falling away. I mean, how many people do you know in that category? Who said they were a Christian, they were excited for a little bit, they came into church, and they seemed zealous and earnest, and all of a sudden, bam, they hit with a trial, hit with a test, and they're gone. Right? Jesus, you don't have to turn there, but Jesus obviously explains this very well in the parable of the sower. Just listen to this. He says, those seed on the rocky soil, this type of person we're talking about, are those who, when they hear, receive the word with joy. There's an initial excitement. But they have no firm root, Jesus says. They believe for a while, and in the time of temptation, they fall away. In other words, there was shallowness. John Bunyan puts it in Pilgrim's Progress quite well. His dialogue that the dialogue Christian has with Hopeful. Just listen to this. He's talking about this shallowness. He says, though the consciences of such men are awakened, yet their minds are not changed. Therefore, when the power of guilt weareth away, that which provoked them to be religious ceases. Therefore, they naturally turn to their own course again. Thus I say, being hot for heaven by virtue only of the sense and fear of the torments of hell, as their sense and fear of damnation chills and cools, so their desires for heaven and salvation cool also. So then it comes to pass that when their guilt and fear is gone, their desires for heaven and happiness die, and they return to their course once again. End quote. Shallowness. Let me give you a fourth word, a fourth source. And this could be easily number one, but there was no particular order I put these in. Number four is worldliness. Worldliness. You could actually say sinfulness, but we'll use the word worldliness. You can interchange it with sinfulness. And obviously here I'm thinking of Demas. Remember Demas? 2 Timothy 4:10. Demas was with Paul, serving with Paul, probably preaching alongside Paul. What happened to him? Paul tells us, Demas, having loved this present world, has deserted me. He's apostatized. Why? What was the source? What was the cause? Because he loved the world, Paul says. And you know what? It's always like that. Remember what I said? It's ultimately, it goes back to that. It's a love for the world. It's a love for sin. That's why, can I say, and we've preached on it over the years, but I know many churches don't do it. It's so important that you understand how to mortify sin. How you mortify, you know what I mean by mortify sin, right? Paul says in Romans 8, and he says it again in Colossians 3, put to death the deeds of the flesh. In Romans 7, we still have a principle of flesh in us, right? We're born again, we're new creatures, but there's hanging on this a dead man, as it were. Remember he says, I do the things I don't want to do, and I should be doing the things, but I don't do those either. Who is going to deliver me from this dead man that's hanging on me? You know the imagery that he's using, right? If you were a murderer, if you killed somebody in the Roman world, the way that they would execute you is put the body of that person you killed on your back. They would strap it on your back, and you would have to live the rest of your days with that dead man on your back. And is that dead man deteriorated? All the poisons and the toxins of that dead man wasting away would obviously come into you, seep into your pores, seep into your body, and you would die also. That's what Paul is saying. I've got a dead man here, and I can't wait to get rid of it, right? Romans 7 is the Christian who understands that I still have a principle of sin in me, and I need to kill it. I need to mortify it. And if you don't, here's the world, as I say. It's out there as a bait. It's out there as a lure. And you're just going to feed those temptations. You're going to give in. I remember reading Martin Lloyd-Jones's Spiritual Depression, and he did a number of chapters of why Christians are depressed. I mean, the diagnosis is quite logically, and I remember he's saying the bulk of Christians who are spiritually depressed are those who have never learned how to mortify their sin, because you give in to temptation, you give in to temptation, you don't overcome it, and you're left, and I would be depressed as well. Just can't get over the sin, this besetting sin. John Owen said, you be killing sin or sin will be killing you, right? Or as one author put it, when you become so blind that the maker of galaxies and ruler of nations and knower of all mysteries and lover of our souls becomes boring, then the only thing left is the love of the world. For the heart is always restless. It must have its treasure, if not in heaven, then on earth. End quote. In other words, worldliness. Worldliness. Let me give you another thought here. Number five, covetousness. Covetousness. I mean, if worldliness is a love for sin, then covetousness is a love for what? Stuff. And that's all it is. Things. Stuff. And listen, a love for things can never coexist with a love for God, right? You can't have a love for the world and all its stuff and a love for God. I mean, that was Israel, right? That's why Elijah brought them all up onto Mount Carmel and says, hey, let's make a decision today. Who is God? Is Baal God or is Yahweh God? You guys are in the language in the Hebrew is limping. You keep limping on 2 feet. In other words, your 2 feet aren't on the ground at the same time. One day it's over here. One day it's over here. God says, I'll have no other gods before me. So make a decision. Let's have a test. Let's have a showdown, as it were. Right? And you know the story in 1 Kings 18. Covetousness. Again, you go back to David, man after God's own heart. But he coveted, right? Same story. He saw Bathsheba. He saw Bathsheba, and what did he want? He wanted her. He didn't have her, but he wanted her. That was covetousness. And what led to that? Adultery, murder, stealing. He practically violated all the Ten Commandments, right? So the point here is a covetous heart is a sure cause for backsliding. I mean, this is how the Apostle Paul put it. He put it in 1 Timothy 6:10, for the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And by longing for it, some have wandered away from the faith. There it is. They say they were Christians, they said they believed, and they looked over and they saw all this money, the potential to have all this money, and the covetousness just drew them out of it. And then Paul adds, and pierced themselves with many pangs. I actually understand that. I remember early in my Christian life, there I was, brand new Christian, working at a bank and the potential to make oodles of money. Oodles of money. And the tug was there. The tug was there. Now, Lord willing, I wasn't going to abandon Christ for it all, but the tug was there to the point that I understand what he meant by pangs and griefs. Listen, the love of money, the love of things, the love of stuff, that will make someone make a shipwreck of their faith. So covetousness. By the way, I think I can just add, covetousness normally comes out of, covetousness is a hard thing, right? You always wondered about the 10th commandment is do not covet. How do you legislate that, by the way? I mean, if someone kills, you can do that. Someone lies, you could be found out. Right? Adultery, you can be found out. How do you get found out for covetousness? You ever think about that? Well, here's the thought. Covetousness normally comes out in complaining. Right? And we go back to the Hebrews. They coveted, and they complained. Number six. We've got to keep moving here. Number six, selfishness. And the first person I thought on this was Solomon. And because he's the son of David, you would have thought he would have learned. I mean, you read the book of Ecclesiastes, and look, it's a bit of a confession, right? He looks back at his life and he says, I was selfish. I wanted this. I did this. I had to have this. I. And what comes out of selfishness? What's behind selfishness? Pride, arrogance. Listen, that is always the path to falling away. And if not for the grace of God, it leads men to apostasy and destruction. Bunyan, of course, got this. Listen again to his dialogue that he has between Christian and hopeful describing the apostates. He says, they are full of pride, unwilling to face the world shame that comes with the gospel. The shame that attends religion lies also as a block in their way. They are proud and haughty, and religion in their eye is low and contemptible. Therefore, when they have lost their sense of hell and the wrath to come, they return again to their former course. Selfishness. I. Alongside that, number seven, we'll call this self-righteousness. Selfishness runs right into self-righteousness, or another way of putting this, prayerlessness. Because if you're self-righteous, you won't pray, right? Because if you think you can attain salvation by your good works, right? My way, my boasting. I mean, this is the epitome of unbelief, right? Self-righteousness. That was the Pharisees. He stood on the corner, and who did he pray to? He prayed to himself. Did you ever pick up that? Luke 18. There's the Pharisee, standing in the corner. Don't be like him. Ah, I pray to myself that I am not like that guy or that guy. Now, you may not be sitting on the corner praying to yourself, but you might be looking over here and say, well, I'm not like that guy. Isn't that how the world works? I'm not as bad as that guy. And that guy's over there saying, well, I'm not as bad as that guy. And that guy says, I'm not as that bad guy. And then it spirals down to whoever the lowest pawn of society is, right? And he becomes the standard. But he's not the standard, is he? Who's the standard? Be perfect as what? I am perfect. God's the standard. We have to attain his righteousness, right? And so the apostate says, forget God's way. I'm going to establish my own righteousness. Isn't that what the Jews did? Isn't that what Paul says? Self-righteousness, prayerlessness. Number eight. Let me give you another source of apostasy. Bitterness. Think about it. Bitterness. The writer of Hebrews actually mentions this. Go over to Hebrews 12 for a moment. Look at Hebrews 12, verse 15. He says there, see to it that no one comes short of the grace of God. This is a warning. And look at what he says next, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many defiled. How many folks do you know have walked away from the church? Primarily because of this. There was a disagreement, maybe in the church with somebody. Maybe somebody betrayed them, backstabbed them. Maybe there was an offense given in the church. And the Bible, of course, tells us to live in unity, live in peace, forgive one another, at the end of Ephesians. But the heart was hard. And the person didn't want to forgive. The person actually resented and became bitter and then what? Walked right out the door. All of us, I think, know cases of that, right? And they were offended, they became disappointed, they became disillusioned, and then they ultimately disappeared. Why? Because there was no forgiveness, no reconciliation. There was only hardened bitterness. And again, that's why there's so much emphasis in the New Testament on the importance of unity. I mean, here, look at it in the big picture. We're supposed to be salt. We're supposed to be light. And the church to live in unity of peace, it's a constant, what? Reconciling with one another, constant forgiveness with one another. Why? Because we're going to collide often, right? Offense is going to be given almost every day, if not every week. And we need to keep short accounts. We need to come and say, look, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. You need to go make it right. I mean, in fact, what Jesus says, don't even come and bring your altar till you make it right with your brother, right? But if you don't make it right, then your heart becomes hard. And that then becomes resentful. And then that becomes bitter. And there's the spiraling down where you say, you know what, I've had enough of this. I don't like those people. I don't like their God. I don't like their Savior. Bitterness and unforgiveness, listen, it becomes like gangrene in a church. It breeds suspicion with everyone and makes people separate with one another. And it happens in the church. By the way, it happens in the home, doesn't it? It happens in the home. Marriages dissolve ultimately because bitterness reigns in the heart rather than forgiveness. In fact, can I just say all relationships? I've been around a while. And I would say that all relationships that dissolve, that are broken, can be traced back to the point where there was no forgiveness given. I think I'm right, yeah? So bitterness. Number nine, foolishness. foolishness. I mean, this is really the message of Hebrews. I had to pull this one, a foolishness. I mean, foolishness is in every single one of them, but foolishness, just to say it, is why would you go back? Why would you apostatize? I mean, the writer of Hebrews is saying Jesus is better and better and better. He's better, you know, the new covenant is better. He's a better priesthood. He's a better sacrifice. I mean, why would you go back to the old? Right? You would be a fool to go back. That's my point. Foolishness. Proverbs 28:28 says, he who trusts in his own heart is a fool, but he who walks wisely will be delivered. Don't be a fool. Don't be a fool. But that's oftentimes the source of backsliding and apostasy. Number 10, fearfulness. I get this one, fearfulness. I mean, this was, again, certainly a real one for the Hebrews. They got pressure from the family, right? We've said this week after week. Pressure from the family. Some of you know that. Some of you have left whatever religion you come from. That's huge. That's huge. Whether you come from a Muslim family, a Catholic family. I mean, to walk away from that is offensive to your family. And they'll let you know it, right? It's shame to you, on the family. So they got pressure from the family. And then on top of that, these Hebrews had persecution, right? Nero's on the throne. Nero's on the throne and he's burning Christians in his backyard as candles. Or feeding them to the lions. Pressure from the family, persecution from the king. I don't think I want this. I'm out of here. Fearfulness. So idleness, shallowness, worldliness, covetousness, selfishness, self-righteousness, bitterness, foolishness, fearfulness, and just one more. One more. I'll call this depression. 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 I want to come back and talk more about this sometime because our time is running out. Some time ago, I was just thinking about, you know, how do we get to a depressed state? Now, I'm not talking about going to your doctor and being diagnosed as whatever they call it, chronically depressed. I'm not talking about that. I'm just, you know, you read the Psalms. I mean, Jeremiah and his Lamentations, he's depressed. You read Elijah. I mean, right after the 1 Kings 18 and the victory there, you could say, he hears that Jezebel's after him, and so he goes and flees and sits under a juniper tree and what? He's depressed. And we all get depressed to a point. But let me just put it in a category. And as I said, I thought about this some time ago. I mean, here we are as Christians, and much to be joyful for, much to be happy. I mean, on Christmas, we talked about how Mary was exalted. Exalting God and the joy that was coming out of her in her, you know, Magnificat, right? Elizabeth and what she said and the angels and the reaction of the shepherds and Simeon, there was absolute joy when we see Christ and we know Christ and we embrace Christ by faith and we're saved. There's joy, right? And there should be joy throughout the Christian life, but things hit us. The trials and the tests of life come. And we get discouraged at times, right? Or let me start with disappointment. Disappointment. We have disappointments. Disappointments are all part of life. Now we would like to think we can just bounce back. I mean, you're not going to live a life full of fulfillments. You're going to have disappointments. But if you linger on the disappointments, it's going to transition into what I call the discouragements. And if you don't bounce back from that, that'll turn into the despondency, right? And if you don't fight back on despondency, that'll turn into this depression, as I said. And if you don't bounce back from that, that'll just lead you to despair. You see the spiraling down? I've not seen that in a book. That was my own little way of putting it all together. Because, look, the life is going to bring you, and even God himself is going to bring you trouble and tests. And you wanted that job, or you wanted that girl. Whatever it is, it doesn't happen. You get disappointed. And if you don't talk to yourself like the psalmist, and say, why is my soul in despair? But say, you know what? God's in control. God's sovereign. Okay, he didn't want me to have that girl. He didn't want me to have that job. He didn't want me. I mean, again, you got to talk to yourself. You got to take the scriptures and put it in play, right? But if you don't, that discouragement will turn into disappointment. That disappointment will turn into despondency. That despondency will turn into depression. And that depression will turn into what? Despair. So where do you fight it? Well, you should fight it at discouragement. You should fight at disappointment. But I tell you, if you miss those two, you have to fight it at despondency. But once it gets to the depression state, the potential of apostatizing is even greater. And that's my point here. What's the source of apostasy? Some would say depression. Depression. You say, what causes depression? Well, sin causes depression, right? Sin causes depression. Vain regrets causes depression. Stress causes depression. I mean, you look out into the world with this whole COVID. You look at the bills that are being in Parliament about to be passed, where there's the suppression of you can't say homosexuality is a sin, or you can't try to help a transgender person to come out of their transgenderism. I mean, there's persecution on the rise. The threat of terrorism. Health issues. We all have health issues and this COVID thing running around. I mean, stress, vain regrets, and of course, sin. So depression can launch you onto a path of apostasy. You say, where are you going on all with all of this, Todd? Well, let's wrap it all up here now. And here's the point. When you look at these sources of backsliding apostasy, and whether it's idleness, shallowness, worldliness, covetousness, selfishness, self-righteousness, bitterness, foolishness, fearfulness, depression, and we could add a whole bunch more, but we'll stop there. When we look at all of these sources, and they're real sources, aren't they? I see heads being nodded as we've been going through them. I am here, listen, I am here to tell you that with each one of them, there is a remedy. You got that? There is a solution. And what's the solution? Well, in a real sense, it's the message of Hebrews. The message of Hebrews, because all the Hebrews had these. Right? Every person that he wrote to had one of these 11. And so, as a whole, the message of Hebrews is the remedy and the solution. And you say, well, what is it? Well, in two words. I mean, if you're looking for the source of backsliding, the answer always is what? The answer is who? Jesus Christ. Did you get that? Always. That's why he says, consider him, right? Look to him. Listen to him. Don't harden your hearts. That's the warning. Don't harden your hearts. Listen to him. Look to him. He's not just the supreme and majestic. He's what? He's sufficient. Don't look outside. Don't look outside. Don't look at whatever the world offers you as a solution and remedy. You have everything pertaining to life and godliness. Do you understand that? Everything. It might take some work. It's not a let go, let God. You have to discipline yourself for godliness, right? But the solution always comes back to that. Always comes back to Jesus Christ. That's why, you know what? That's why Hebrews, I mean, it's theological, it's Christological, and you have to know the Old Testament. At the end of the day, though, it's practical, right? It's practical because everyone finds themselves backsliding at times. Everyone finds themselves in a spiritual wilderness. And whatever the source is, whatever the cause is, the one to lead you out every single time is Jesus Christ, if you're a Christian. The only one to lead you out of your spiritual apathy, to lead you out of your spiritual sluggishness every single time is the name above all names, and that's Jesus Christ. Amen?